You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nick Montfort. Nick, thanks so much for being with me today.
I'm glad to be here.
And Nick, you're in, what did you say? You're in Union Square Park?
Yeah.
Down in
here in Union Square. Yes, that's right.
So let's talk about what you're working on now. What's the latest project that you're involved in?
Well, it's a good question. It depends on which of my Janus faces I have on. I am finishing up a project for MIT Press that is a very short book that took a long time to write. And now, actually, when I checked for this confirmation message, I saw that the page proofs just arrived. So I'm at the very end of that process. But the book is called The Future. And maybe I should let you ask me something about that because it sounds like a pretty big topic.
Yeah, well, let's get into it then. So, and I know it is a kind of a vast topic. That's a lot going on. So the book, yeah, what is that? What is this book about? I mean, it seems straightforward, but I'm sure it's not. What is the future?
Let me give you some context. So this is part of the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series, and it's in some ways, you know, you must know the very short introduction books that are all over every bookstore that the Oxford University Press does, right?
Right.
So these are great, and I've read a bunch of them, and to me they read like, I would describe them as like really good encyclopedia articles. In fact, I think that's sort of where, I would say that's where Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, is today, where it lives its best life. The Essential Knowledge series for MIT Press is quirkier. It's more experimental. It does the types of stuff that MIT does, not the types of stuff that Oxford does particularly. And so they have books on the conscious mind, the technological singularity, paradox, not always things you would think were essential, but they're going to, you know, keep them in print for a while, see if people are wanting to read this stuff. Great book on memes. Really good stuff. I should say, I don't think I had anything to do with acquiring any of these, but I am on the MIT Press editorial board. So look, take it. If I'm shilling for the press, I want to admit that. So anyway, I'm doing this book, almost done with this book on the future. And it's not at all an encyclopedia article. It's my view of how people who are interested in changing the world for the better and building a better future, you know, what can they actually do? And I look at it from the standpoint of, you know, the field that I'm in, digital media, new media, to some extent, even arts and poetry.
So that is a great question. And are you going over different individuals and what they've done? Is there case histories, or are you approaching a different?
Yeah. Well, sure. There's some discussion of people like Doug Engelbart, Alan Kay, Nicholas Negroponte via the OLPC project, Ted Nelson. You know, so these are all people really important to me, to my formation in new media. Some earlier people, but one of the reasons I mentioned the Oxford series is actually just as I was finishing the book, I saw on the shelf they came out with a book also called The Future in this series, and I have it with me. It's one of the things I'm reading right now, and it's a masterful book that is encyclopedic. It's by a you know, someone in the future studies field, actually probably the major person, as far as I know, in the future studies field, Jennifer Gidley. And it's, you know, if you want the authoritative view, it's a great book. If you want more of the renegade view, I still am pleased that I wrote the book that I wrote because, it draws on my own interest. I've done writing that relates to utopian writing, and so I talk about utopia in the book. And am I giving you an idea of what the project is sort of about?
Yeah, let's talk about maybe one of the profiles in there to kind of discuss what one of the industries might be doing, because in a sense this is a question that's important for a lot of artists, especially at this moment in history, right?
How about we talk about, so it's not exactly a person, but how about we talk about the Italian futurists? It's a very unconventional choice for this type of book, because they're very problematic as a group. I mean, that's an understatement, I think. You know, they were misogynist, colonialist, racist overtly in their writings. I don't mean to lump everybody together, because Giacomo Balla actually, you know, was not obsessed with technological destruction. He was one of the more utopian figures. But Marinetti, I'm sure we're thinking the same thing about, you know, this guy who, you know, has his car crashes and his wanting to cleanse the past, and he wants to start over. He sees technology as a way to, you know, get rid of the museums and libraries. I don't solve that problem in one chapter of a tiny book. But what I'm trying to say is, well, is there anything we can take from that? Should we get rid of that part of our history? Or is there anything we can take from what the futurists did? And I think there is. I think that the way they worked across media, they didn't just embrace, they didn't claim that they were into new media and into the latest things that technology, you know, was up to. But they also went on, and they printed leaflets and they dropped them from the bell tower, the church. You know, they practiced what they did. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe too much, but they were practice what you preach is the ecclesiastical way to put it. I think in business they call it eating your own dog food. You know. You make a product and you have to use a product. So the futurists did it, and I think they were better and they left more for us to learn from because they did. I don't think people should be fascist, you know, but you can look at that and say, well, it wasn't a total waste. I mean, nobody in the arts thinks. I don't think anybody in the arts thinks it was a total waste. I don't think anyone would. When they put up a futurist,
it was controversial. I mean, the Guggenheim had a show not long ago about the futurists, and exactly. Which in itself was controversial. But I think that that's an interesting. Yeah, it is a very interesting choice to use for the book, because in a way it seems a little bit of a stretch is how you're going to think about the futurists and what they did.
It was. And I have to tell you. Yeah. I mean, this is one of these cases. I got an anonymous review, very positive. And there was just this one sort of like worry in the review of like, what's this about the futurists? How is this going to fit into the book? So of course my response to this group was, well, this person was very thoughtful, you know, and I was like, well, maybe I need to think about that a little more. So I actually put a lot of effort into that that particular part. I mean, some of the parts that are maybe better that were less effort, but I was really interested, you know, to do well by that.
Now, so the people who are reading the book now, they're, you know, or when it's out, you're talking about futurists. How do you imagine that people will interpret the futurists and what you're writing about them in terms of how we see our future now?
Well, one of the ways you could say is they're I'd say they were bold people. They wanted to write the future. They wanted to make art that would determine the future. They wanted to do better. But they reacted. They didn't know how to do it. You know, I mean, they thought that they had to cry out. I mean, this is before World War I, they were already saying, you know, let's have revolution. You know, I mean, this. And a few years later, people were in the trenches. You know, dying by the millions. And they were setting up the cries. They were glorifying war quite overtly. So you know, one of the things you might say is be a little bit more nuanced. You know. But also have ideas and have principles. See if you can stick to them. Be in dialogue. Don't be a crank. Be in dialogue with, you know, the people outside your self and outside your movement.
And this speaks to artists as well as writers, intellectuals. What do you think is the audience that's reading?
I hope so. You know how these. I mean, you know how these things are. I have an idea of who my readership is, and I try to do, and I have sometimes particular people in mind, like I want to write this book for this person, or I want to, you know, write this book for a very, very well-defined number of group of people, right? And then other people pick up the book, and they find something in it. So to some extent, yeah, I mean, it's about people. The people who I hope that it resonates with. Some people pick up this book and say, yeah, I know everything in it already. So some of my colleagues, I think, in digital media and new media, I suspect will be completely unsurprised by this book and not need to read it. I don't mean 100 people, but you know, five or 10 people who are really have been very parallel to my work. And then there's other people beyond that, you know, who are going to find an interesting thing here and there. And then who knows? So to me, that's my hope for the book.
And when you look at movements that are happening now, I mean, it's so interesting. I think the idea of learning from the futurists, you know, I would think some of the other examples you mentioned, or there's so many other things we could talk about, especially in digital media. But the futurists were before all that, so it becomes something it sounds to me more about principles, about approach, as opposed to the content that they're working with, because some of them.
Yeah. Well, they weren't before new media. There was definitely new media at the time, you know, being able to print posters on letterpress in large quantity. There were new media technologies were coming about, so the futurists in a certain way. You know what I hope you know what I'm trying to say here. New media is the stuff that it's sort of like that's what was invented after you're born or whatever, you know. So there was new media. There was what McLuhan would, you know, call electric media. There were streetcars and, you know, all this stuff. So I don't think it's entirely. I don't think it's reaching too far in terms of being. From myself or from new media, you know. I think it's connected in my view.
And so that's exciting. And when will that book come out?
I believe it'll be November, December. You know, it'll be in November, December.
And so before we go, there's I know you're having upcoming talks. There's different things that that you'll be talking on. Is there?
Yeah.
You want to talk about one of those? Are you doing a workshop on machine learning for creativity? Aren't you at coming up?
Yeah. Well, it's not, I'm just giving a short invited talk, so I'm basically going to go up there and try to poke my I wouldn't call them my fellow computer scientists, but I do have a background in computer science, so I'm going to try to see what I can do to productively stir the pot up there a little bit. But I'm also doing a poetry reading, and it's actually going to be in Troy later in August. And I'm going to show a lot of the work that I do in multilingual poetry, usually with collaborators. So I collaborate a lot. I work across languages. And I'm also interested in inviting people to learn about programming, not by doing linked lists, you know, and binary search and the typical sorts of computer science things, but actually by doing creative projects that are still connected to the essentials of computing, learning how to program in a basic way. So,
what is that approach as opposed to links and HTML and as you're saying, binary language?
You can learn it. You can use HTML to learn these sorts of things. But let me give you an example. So B.P. Nichol in 1984, he made this thing called First Screening. Incredible, beautiful. Do you know the piece?
I don't know the piece.
Okay, so Nichol, you know about Nichol. He was part of the Horsemen in Canada with Steve McCaffrey and company.
Right.
It's right. Avant-garde. Yeah, I mean, so he had this computer. He was doing some work. You know, he bought, I don't know what he was doing, but he bought an Apple II, probably Apple II Plus. I don't know exactly. And he was doing some work, and he's like, well, why don't I make a poetry thing? Because, you know, he did, that was what he did all the time. Whenever he was, he encountered anything new, he was like, how do I make a poem in it? How do I make something? So he taught himself to program in BASIC, and he wrote, a good long BASIC program that it sort of simulates, I don't know what it simulates, but it's a collection of short, simple digital poems. They're animated. They're not interactive. And they're there on the Apple too. And, he didn't have any programming. As far as I know, he didn't take courses in programming, he just was a smart guy who noodled around with a computer that he had. And he learned about this. So I think a lot of people, I think that's a mode in which a lot of people that I meet who, would never call themselves programmers can learn about how to use computing to be expressive, conceptual, to explore, to create, So for me, it's a big deal.
And so to talk a little bit about your reading at St. Rocco's that you were talking about in that's coming up. What will you be reading there, and how will that reflect? And maybe we can talk a little bit about how you work with poetry and different languages.
Sure, sure. I'm going to read. What I'm going to do will be like a traditional poetry reading in a lot of ways. In some ways, it'll be like a multimedia reading. So I'll show things on the screen, and to that crowd, I don't think I would shock them with anything that I'm going to, have to offer. I'm going to read from a long poem. I'm going to read some things that are more sort of conceptual, but maybe connected. I don't claim to be a conceptualist, but sort of connected to that, right?
Right.
And then basically what I'm going to do in that case is I'm going to pull the curtain back a little bit and say, look, this is how I did it. If you want to know, I can come talk to me. I'll tell you how to. There's books you can read. There's places you can start if you want to learn this. So, a poetry reading, that's the type of thing.
So, learn what exactly? Like, what would they be learning through those books?
Just how computation works with language and literary art. Just how you can use computing to do things with language and literary art. Not my thing. Not to express, Nick Montfort, but to express their own voices, even in different languages. I've done some work in Spanish at MIT. Not asking people to translate my work, but saying, make new work. Do what you want to do. So I'm trying to facilitate that, but one entry point, to it. I mean, I like the poetry too. I don't think it's, I don't think it's bad. I like that aspect. And if somebody just didn't get anything about what I was doing with computing and they liked the language, that's great too. I'm totally into that. But the people who are interested and who want to do more, I want it to be a way in.
And the way in for them is, in other words, they might not necessarily be poets. But it's a way into kind of exploring language. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, most of the people I work with are poets or artists in some way. Yeah, I mean, or most of the people, even when I invite them. I mean, I work with a librarian, for instance, at MIT, who collaborated with me on a book, and you know, but I mean, she does literary translation. So, you know, I mean, there's also, so the, most of the people who I work with, and I'm trying to say, like, look, you can do this. I guess I'm trying to be more of a coach and not, you know, I'm not trying to be a didact. I'm not trying to instruct people. You, if you want programming instruction, it's all over the place. You don't have to go. I could probably find it, you know, within 1,000 feet of where I'm sitting here in Union Square.
Right.
Like Day of Code, you know, I could go to Barnes & Noble. I could get, you know, JavaScript in 21 days. You know, there's all sorts of ways you can get instruction. So I'm trying to be a good coach for people to be able to do their own work.
And just to get into that a teeny bit more, and being a good coach for people to do their own work, it's what is that as precisely as you can get to it? There, you're pointing them in certain directions, but as poets, they're understanding how to use computational language, the computer to
I would say here's some exercises, you know, or here's like, I would say, yeah, like if you want to know how you wouldn't, like, for instance, I mean, I don't know what your background is in computing, but you know, there are loops, there's iteration where you make you have an instruction and you want it to happen a certain number of times, right? Or maybe you want to have it keep going, the classic, like 10, you know, approximately my first computer program I ever wrote, 10 print, Nick rules, 20 go to 10, right? And so that just prints that again and again and again and again. And then eventually you can turn the computer off or break it or whatever. So that's you can actually start learning about iteration that way if you think about it, you know, if you just stop there and you're like, I know how to do that, you know, it's not very good. But if you actually think about this, you're like, wow, you know, it's just as easy for the computer to do this like 10,000 times as it is to do it once. So if I want to make a poem or a visual art piece that just keeps running, I could do that. Why not? It doesn't hurt. I mean, obviously it takes, you know, it takes a sliver of power. I'm not talking about putting it, you know, on Times Square or something, but you know, but it's not that hard for the computer to do that. So those are the types of things that I would offer as like exercises or, you know, micro projects. But I want people to choose what they want to do once they have enough background that they can make that choice.
Right, and get more involved in the language itself and explore that so they can then create things that are a combination of iterations and other things that you haven't even spoken of yet that are of course also part of computational
language. Yeah, that sounds, right? I mean, that sounds generally right, that people would, you know, that basically it's sort of like, you know, for me, if you go to a poetry program, one of the things you can learn is to just how to put words together. You don't have to learn how to write like your teachers, right? You can learn from people who are different from you, but you learn things about how vowels and consonants go together, about how words can be put in sequence, about how a line turns into the next line, right?
Right.
If you're writing verse, for instance. Hmm. So if that's a good experience for you, you don't have to come out writing like your teacher, you know?
Right. It's really interesting. And so if people wanted to get more involved in this, there's of course your book that's coming out and other things you've written. Is there other resources that you can imagine for people to get involved in just what we're talking about now through poetry and computational language? I mean, maybe it's a workshop.
Sure. I mean, I do workshops various places. Yes. If people are coming by MIT when I'm there, my door's open and I'll talk with them. You know, one of the reasons that I am able to talk about this is because with any type of coherence is because I did write a book for MIT Press called Exploratory Programming for the Arts and Humanities. And, I tried to sort of embody my coach, sort of self, you know, for people who are interested in the literary art and visual art and the humanities and other types of work. That's hopefully that's in that book. It's a textbook, but I try to write it with individual learners in mind also, so that somebody could pick it up and, you know, they could read it. And not just read it, but go through it, learn from the exercises, and they would get something out of it. Not everyone gets the same thing out of any textbook, but, you know, I did try to make it useful.
Well, Nick, it's great talking to you. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now, the question I ask everybody at the end.
Yeah. So one of the things that I had trepidation, you know, in starting it was this other very short book called The Future, is arriving
right.
right on the cusp of when I had to. Now that I've got the proofs for my book, I think I'm liberated to read it. But the book that I'm actually in the middle of is Traversal by Deanie Gregar and Stuart Malthrop, and it's a great. I'm embarrassed to say that I'm reading it now because it came out a few months ago. It's also an MIT Press book. I know Deanie and Stuart very well. It's one of these things like never going to the, you know, living in New York and never going to the Empire State Building, you know, it's like,
right.
And it's a bit, it turns out to be, it's a magnificent and incredibly useful and thoughtful book. And so I'm reading it. This is the time I read a lot of books sort of flipping a few pages at a time, if you know what I mean. And,
sure.
This book, I have my pencil out and I'm going through the margins and this one I'm trying to. It's called Traversal, really trying to make a crossing. It's a term used in climbing. It's a term Michael Joyce used. So this I'm trying to traverse through the book here, and I'm not just trying to skip.
Nick, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been fascinating.
You bet.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.